brother Nels was my favorite brother, and he drowned while I was working at the bank here in 1975, I believe. He went down on a boat that was called the St. Mark, and none of the bodies were ever recovered, and it's just kind of sad. But he was my favorite brother because he was just so full of life, and he could tell you stories that would intrigue you, because he'd been everywhere. He'd been in the Air Force before he was a fisherman, so he knew all kinds of stories and keep us enthralled with them. And he also, after my mom died in 1962, he kind of helped my dad keep us together as a family. And then my next brother Norman, I don't really know. He came to visit my mom periodically. Don't know him too well. Then my brother Sam, who lives here in Alaska, lives over in Homer. He comes through and visits me once in a while. He's just full of life, and I really enjoy him and his family. Most of my family, after Unga moved to Sandpoint, Alaska, and I have three sisters and two brothers that live there, actually. Sandpoint is right next to Unga, Alaska. It's just a hop and a skip. In fact, I understand from the Unga history that the Sandpoint children used to go to school in Unga. They were just bowed over and go to school there. It's kind of interesting. Knew that. But I have another brother. I have another brother, Glenn, who lives here in Kodiak in Port Lyons. And I have a brother, Dan, that lives in Larson Bay, Alaska, here on the island. And he's the one that comes and visits me more than anybody else. We're closest in age. And of my sisters, my sister Nellie and I were the closest, but she's now has passed on, and she was also my dad's favorite of the older sisters because she was full of life, and she looked like a big Italian Mamma Mia, really, because she just had that. She was a big native lady, and it looked like she was permanently pregnant because she was deformed when she had polio when she was younger. I have another sister, Virginia, lives over in the Melchick with all of her clan. She has, by the way, 13 children and about 100 grandchildren, I guess, by now. And, not really. And then I have a sister I have never met. What is it? Christine. And she lives in Iowa somewhere. She's married to a Methodist preacher. I have a sister, Myrtle, who kind of keeps everybody together. She's next after my brother Dan, and she's kind of like a family historian. She knows everything, all the relatives, all the aunts and uncles. And then my sister Florence lives also in, they both live in Sandpoint, by the way. She's one of the older sisters, and she just came to visit me last year with her husband. They've had some interesting lives too. But they both live in Sandpoint, and they're fishermen. Like that life there, and I don't think either one of them graduated from high school. Then my sister that's closest in age to me, Alice, interesting story about her is that she was adopted out to the teachers at Unga when I was there, I was younger, and I think I probably grieved over it, and I don't mean remember, but I her nickname was Lala, and I still call her that. But she lives down in the Seattle area. And then the ones in my immediate family, my sister Frances, who's a year younger than I, lives in San Diego with her husband and her son. And then my brother Bjorn lives in Sandpoint. So. And my other sister Leif lives in Sandpoint. By the way, Bjorn and Leif, or we call her Leafy, they're both Norwegian names. My father's influence on the family, Leafy lives there. She has four children here. Some are in college right now, and my mother had us one right after the other, so we're like a year apart, and that's it. The Lee family, anyway. And that's all my family and brothers and sisters. I have tons of aunts and uncles, and I don't know half of them because I haven't been back to the village at Sandpoint for since 1959.
Is this real common for the people that are in the villages to stay generation after generation, or are they also part of the transient populations today?
I think some stay and some are transient, because many people that lived in Sandpoint during my early age have moved out to the Seattle area. They live down there now. In fact, I have quite a few relatives out there, because that's where everybody went after fishing to go spend their money. You know, you didn't go to Anchorage to buy things. You went to Seattle to do your orders. And usually they took their boats down that way to go get repairs done at the mobile boat yards. So that's what attracts them to Seattle. And it's by the ocean. And it's a big city. I believe I mentioned that my mom died in 1962. And I was just 11 years old, and my dad raised us, each one, the rest of us, five of us. My brother Dan was still at home. My sister Merle decided to go back to Sandpoint and married a local fisherman there. And so there was five of us at home, and my dad raised us with the Norwegian discipline. He had Lutheran influence background there, so. Yeah, the authoritarian, so we didn't really fear him, but he just had to say one time, and we listened, jumped. Not actually jumped, but we obeyed, actually, because he had to have a smooth running household, and we all had our specific duties to do and chores, and he taught all of us how to cook and basically how to take care of a household on our own. And his experience from raising children when he was in Kodiak in the 40s, he helped raise John Holland's children, which, by the way, is Holland Ranches, which is where St. Mary's is right now. And my dad said he could have had the property there for $3,000 when he was younger, but he was single and he didn't care to have it then. And, you know, hindsight's always 50-50 or 20-20, whatever. Anyway, the welfare almost took us away from our dad, but the local people ran interference and said, give him a year and see how he does with the kids by himself. And since my dad was at home anyway, and he was there all the time, we didn't, he basically was mother and father, it was Mr. Mom, the original. and he kept a tight ship there, I guess. From being on the boat, he knew how to keep a tight ship. And we had a very colorful life because he had lots of fishermen buddies that come through and come up and visit us. And our house was never empty. It was a real tiny house, but it was there was always visitors there, and there was relatives always coming through, passing through, like ships passing in a storm or whatever you want to call it. But he never forced us to go to any particular church or anything. We were all affiliated at that time with our little church that we went to that was across the street from us, and he never discouraged us. He never said we couldn't or anything. So he was a very high moral man. He was very God-fearing. He believed that we should abide by the laws of the Bible, Ten Commandments, and he was really pleased when we learned scripture. And he also, I think he was very influential in our education, because he was very interested in it. And he would do things I wish more parents would do today with their kids, stay at home and read maps, play games with them. He's always given us math combinations and problems to do in our head. He said that we need to do facts in our head. Our house always had Newsweek magazines, or People Magazine, but that's my dating there, but all kinds of news information, and our TV time was very, very limited, and he encouraged us to read books and use the library, and we do our chores, and our time was our own, so we were, we had a good life. Some of it was hard on me, I think, because I was older and was expected to do more, and I ended up being chief cook, but I didn't have to wash dishes, because Dad said whoever cooks doesn't have to do dishes, so that was good. And but we did everything on a cycle. I ended up also being the chief grocery shopper, and we'd make our list and I'd go shop, and we'd order our groceries. In those days, Kraft's grocery shop used to deliver groceries to your house, so that was kind of nice. Whatever happened to those days when things were cheap? And all in all, it was a pretty good life. My dad and I kind of fought sometimes because I had my beliefs and he had his beliefs, and I was very I don't know if you want to say temperamental, but I was very, it's not outspoken, I was introverted. I get my feelings hurt easily because my brothers and sisters could stick up for themselves. They would laugh off everything, but I would always take things too personally or to the heart too much. And it's part of your personality, and you finally work it out. But I used to say things that would hurt my feelings, but I also laugh at it, whatever he said. Mm. I mean, my sisters used to tease him royally about things, and they would bother him, or they wouldn't get bothered by him. But I think part of it is because I was my mama's role. I can remember her carrying me even when I was 4 with my leg still not completely healed. And I also had dark hair. My brothers and sisters, young ones, have red hair and blonde hair. And so, I don't know. And I think I reminded her a lot of my mom too, because I do have similar coloring and features. But we got along, we survived. My dad, even with his low income that he had from his Social Security, was able to save $1,000 to give each one of us to go start our life with after we graduated from high school. So he's very frugal, kind, and open-hearted. He'd let anybody come stay, feed him. He wouldn't let him borrow money, he said, because he didn't want to go. Some of the friends would come through and want to drink it up. He said, I'll feed you, but you're not getting any drinking money.
Is he the one you got your love of books from?
No, actually, my mother was a librarian in the Ungle Library. She's the one that started us on books. I can remember the little kids' book, and the one that sticks in my head was Snip, Snap, and Snurr. That was a little child's book that sticks out of my head. But she was always reading books, and also I think I was influenced by the teachers I had too in Kodiak.
Well, Rosa, it's been really interesting to listen to your family story and all the children your mom had. You made a comment at one point that this was something that had moved forward. Maybe you could close and tell us a little bit about what it's like to be gone from Unalaska, and what it's like looking backwards for someone with a Native heritage.
Well, I was just thinking about Thomas Wolfe's You Can't Go Home Again. I can't remember the title of the book now. But really, you can go back and visit what you were in your memory, and recall it there, and it'd be good if people would write their life histories down. That's kind of a neat thing to do too. But Unga, as far as Unga was a little village town, is no longer. It's just a memory in somebody's mind, and it's a ghost town right now. Maybe one or two families live there, I'm not sure. But it's memories. I don't have all the memories of Unga, just what I have of my personal history. And Kodiak, even when I was growing up, it's changed a lot. grown up into little suburbia, whatever you want to call it, with little city problems, strengths and ideas. And I think culturally it's really, it's a mixed bag of several different cultures, and I think that's good. I think you need to know your neighbors and get along with them and identify with them and realize that everybody basically comes from the same root, just offshoots of different areas. And I liked coming back here after being gone from college, because there were so many things that changed even when I was gone to college, like the Island Bridge. That was just a dream when I was here before, and there are other things. Spanish has always happened, some good, some may not be so good. But I'm glad that the people are trying to recapture their culture, at least to hang on to what their heritage. I think it's important to have a heritage, to have something to look at. But I also think it's important that you also look to your future and make plans for that, and not dwell in the past, but live today and make plans for what tomorrow might give you. And sometimes you don't have plans, but you gotta go on from there. Don't look backwards. Go forward.
Today is April the 5th, 1996. My name is Kim Robinson, and I am interviewing Rosa Wallace, and we're sitting in Kodiak Christian School in Kodiak, Alaska. Rosa, why don't you tell us a little bit of your parents' story, about your mom and her first marriage, and then how she met your dad and what they did after they got married.
My mom was born and raised on the village of Unga, Alaska, which is part of the Shimigin Islands, which is about 250 miles from Kodiak, which is part of the Aleutian chain, by the way. She's Aleut Russian descent. She was married when she was 14 to her sweetheart, Mr. Brandel, and they had 14 children, of whom three of them died before I've never met them. And her husband died also in 1950 or something like that. She met my dad. He came up there to go fishing from Kodiak, and he's originally from Norway. He's lived in Alaska a long time. And my dad was 59 when he met my mom. She was 39, and they got together because my dad said he felt sorry for her because she was a widower with so many children, which I know he loved her, but that was that's the story he liked to tell. Anyway, they got married and had four children, of which I am the oldest.
How long did they stay in Unga?
We moved to Kodiak in 1959. When I was 8 years old, we came up on the boat called the Expansion, which some old timers may remember. It was kind of like a mail boat coming. Moving boat that moved things around, and that's how long we stayed in Kodiak then.
When you were in Unga, Alaska, did you have regular mail service and roads and cars or any conveniences like that, or was it pretty rural?
Unga, Alaska is pretty rural. We got our mail from the fishing boats, I guess they brought them over, and we had board sidewalks and dirt trails, and once a year we ordered our groceries from Seattle, and came up on the bar charge or whatever it came up on. And I remember having to go down to the beach and take the wheelbarrow, and we had to wheel all the groceries up to the house for the year's supply of groceries, and usually it was just canned goods and non-perishables. Didn't have fresh produce, unless you just what we had from our garden, that was it.
What was your first impression of Kodiak when you came on the boat?
Actually, I had been to Kodiak prior to that because I broke my hip when I was 4 years old, and my first impression of Kodiak was the hospital here. And it's the first time I'd ever been on an airplane, first time I'd ever seen a car, first time I'd ever seen streets paved, and it was kind of interesting and scary at the same time. And first time I'd ever seen a doctor or a nun. And I had to stay in the hospital for a whole month. My mother only could stay for a week, and I stayed there by myself for a whole month. And she had friends that would check in on me regularly, but I had to stay suspended with my leg up in the air. And I wasn't sure I was a delightful patient. As, in fact, Dr. Bob Johnson's father was my physician at that time, Dr. Martin Holmes Johnson.
Had you gone to school at all on Ungan?
Yes, we had a what you call a one-room schoolhouse, grades 1 through 8 were there. And Ungan has an interesting history, which I can't go into detail, but it seemed like a little city within a little town, a little village, because a lot of the settlers there were of Norwegian descent. More than the Russian influence. So everything was done like they did in Seattle. They even had their dances and parties and clubs and everything there. For more information, read Ungle Island Girl. That's helpful to me.
It was. So when you came to Kodiak, where did you go to school?
Our first year here, our dad decided that we should go to St. Mary's, primarily because of the transition from village school to a public school, so he thought it would be better to go to a smaller school until we were established in the town and knew what we were doing here.
Now at that time, St. Mary's wasn't in the beautiful new building it has. Where did you go to school?
St. Mary's was downtown, right across, right where Fish and Game building is now, department right across from the Russian Orthodox Church. And the school I was in, first through third grade, was in a Quonset hut, actually. And St. Mary's Old Chapel, which is now their little store they have, was the other building. And so I went first through third together, or not first through, but it was, I believe it was third through eighth grade. We're in one room and had a sister for our teacher.
Then you transferred and went to Kodiak Public Schools?
Yes, I went to Maine Elementary for my fourth grade, which is now the middle school here. And then fifth and sixth grade was downtown in what is called the Little Red Schoolhouse they had downtown, which housed first through sixth grade, I believe. And I went there 2 years, then transferred back up to, in junior high, to the main building, which had K through high school in one building at that time.
How big would you say the town was around 1960?
Small. It was just it's kind of like a sleepy little village town. About 3,000 people maybe, 4,000, I'm not sure. My environment didn't extend very far from our streets because we had to stay within our own neighborhood.
Did you find it fun to have more stores to shop in? Was it different from Ungan, or did you not pay much attention?
I guess I really didn't pay much attention in Ungan. I don't remember us having a store to shop at. I don't think we had a store, as a matter of fact. We did have a library, but there may have been a little store, but I was too young to remember anything about it. But it was kind of I suppose it was a culture shock, but not really. When you're young, things don't shock you as much, I think, as when you're older.
Well, and you know, after you went through your experience at age 4, it probably helped. Tell us a little bit about your church experience here, your church affiliation.
Our first year we went to the Kodiak Bible Chapel, which was at that time called Kodiak Christian Center, which was originally designed for military men to come and have a place to go to that wasn't under the influence of alcoholic beverages, I believe. And we went there, and then across the street from where we lived was the tiny Church of God affiliated with Anderson, Indiana. And that's where I grew up mostly. I went there for about 25 years, which is now the building, and that group has pulled out since from Kodiak, and that building now is the National Bay Baptist Church, if you see it on, I think it's 12th Street or Verona Street, I'm not sure which. And now I'm affiliated with the Church of the Nazarene.
What did your mother's family think of her leaving and going to Kodiak?
Actually, one of the reasons we did move to Kodiak was primarily for my mother's health, because she was having health problems. I'm not sure what they were exactly. I suppose after having 18 children, and she also had a four-pack a day habit of smoking cigarettes, she may have had cancer, we don't know. And other health problems that I wasn't aware of what they were, because I was too young to know what they were. And plus, my sister wanted to go to high school, my older sister, and that's two reasons we moved to Kodiak, basically. And my dad had lived here prior before, during World War II.
Did your dad continue fishing here?
Yes. Well, actually, my dad retired. When we moved to Kodiak, he retired from fishing, because he was in his 60s, and so he was a stay-at-home dad after that.
Let's go back and think again a little bit about what life was like for you as part Native American and part Norwegian. How much of your life really expressed the Native American culture?
In the village I grew up in, I believe a lot of the Native culture was squelched because the Norwegian influence was there so heavily that I don't remember ever doing anything other than the traditional food gathering where they ate off from the land. I don't remember any Native culture things going on in our village. And then we weren't really from Kodiak, so we didn't really affiliate with the natives in Kodiak too much. Our dad's Norwegian influence, we kept in great contact with our relatives in Norway. But up until my father died, I think, because a lot of the cousins were second cousins, and they were quite older than we were even then. Like, when I was in my 20s, my second cousin was in the 60s, so I think we grew up just an average American family in the American traditions, because I noticed that in the village of Under that we did the mom and apple pie sort of thing, 4th of July. I don't remember any Native celebrations at all.
But you were in Kodiak in 1964. Why don't you tell us about what the experience was like for you during the earthquake and the big tsunami?
At that time, it was Good Friday, like today is, and it was a beautiful day, if I remember, and everybody was home because at that time, schools were dismissed on Good Friday. So everybody was home, and I was over at my brother's house going to babysit for him because he and his wife wanted to go out to dinner together. And the earthquake started. I was sitting, and I thought I was getting dizzy. And my brother, who had been in a tsunami before in Unga, understood that it was going to be a tsunami because he went and looked down at the... For some reason, he figured out by going down, looking at the water stirring down at the, which his house is right on the waterfront. And so he said it was going to be a tsunami, so he had me go home. And I lived right where St. Herman's Seminary is right now. That our house is right there on that lot. And so he sent us home, and my dad told all of us to go up to the earthquake. I felt the earthquake, and it rattled and shook, and you could see the telephone poles swaying and the trees bending. And I wasn't downtown where all the mess happened, where all the sidewalks cracked or anything, because most of Kodiak had dirt roads. Razanov was not there yet. It was just a rolling hill of field grass. And basically, Kodiak was centered from the Mill Bay Road was the main road, and Mission Road was the main road. And where Gunnybeck's cut off, where that's where the Mission Road went up to Mill Bay Road, and that's there wasn't any houses or anything out there, out past Razanov. And you could take Mill Bay Road all the way out to Abercrombie. That was about it. That's where they were. Anyway, to go back to the story of the earthquake. The earth quaked all night long. I can remember sitting in the dark. There was no electricity. We were at our house. I was staying with my brother and his family at my house. My dad figured if the water was going to come in, we could get across the street before it got us, because it was just a matter of going up the neighbor's stairs and up on another level. And it was up above the 100-foot mark, I believe. So it was scary to me, because you didn't know what was going on, and you heard all kinds of rumors. And my dad had one of those old-fashioned radios where you could pick up the news from out in the rest of the world, and they were talking about Kodiak having sunk, and I was just wondering, what are they talking about? And it's just this tremendous fear I felt there. And then after a while, I went before it, the sunset. My brother and I and his wife went out in the car, and we could see the little island. I don't remember the name of it, out in the beyond the boat harbor, downtown boat harbor. You could see it going under the water, and then the water receded and coming out, and then you could see houses floating out in the channel, and you know, people on them. You couldn't do anything about it. And I could see the water rising up over on Deer Island. And I believe it went up to the 15-foot level. And all those kind of eerie things. The thing that struck me about the earthquake is before it shook, it was very still and eerie. You couldn't even hear birds twittering or anything. And it was just like nature was pre-warned that it was going to happen. And it was a scary night, but the next day, you know, there was still trembling going on and everything, but you were just glad you were alive. Our family was all together and we're safe, and our house was still there. And we're just thankful that it was in its place. And when we looked around the town, you could see the damage, and it was horrendous. But we're just happy that we're alive, and the hospital is still there where it was, and that building is still standing there. It's just really interesting to me.
How did ANGSA affect your family?
Alaska Native, before ANGSA came, there was urban renewal, which affected our town. After the earthquake, they came in and put in Razanov Street. The ferry system came in, the Testamina, which affected the growth and population of the town. And ANGSA, Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act, kind of gave us ownership to our land. It gave identity to the natives that wasn't there before, especially I think to the Aleutian Island natives, because I think there's people around in the smaller villages on Kodiak that were more connected in the unity because they grew up in their little villages. But the people in Kodiak were, I think, mixed bag. I believe that there really are not any true natives, because they've been all intermixed with the Russians or the Norwegians. But there's like partially natives like I am, and a lot of others along the Aleutian chain, coastal areas. But it kind of gave a unity to the Native people, and I think also gave them some pride, and I know it gave them power, because all of a sudden they had this money to deal with, and a lot of it was not dealt with in a wise way, I think, and especially because people, they have a tendency when you get money, you want to spend it, not save it, and then with the alcoholic problem in Alaska, I think a lot of it got drank up, but went down the bottle, and it really changed a lot of people's lives, because it went from a sleepy village environment to a big business political thing, and then the island becoming a borough also changed it too. All of a sudden, we just don't have Kodiak city government; we have a borough, which new laws and new ideas, and it's just kind of no longer are you just a little unique town, but a part of a bigger system, and having to be laws and regulations of other systems.
When you talked about the urbanization of Kodiak, was this something that was mandated by law, or was this something that just sort of progressed through a variety of reasons?
I think it urbanized because from a variety of reasons. Because of World War II, the Navy base was there already, so there was already a lot of what do you call outside people influences here. But I think people got interested in coming to Alaska, some about a sheer adventure, and some because of the teaching jobs. I think a lot of the Kodiak, you either have fishermen or teachers, or that pay good money here, and Anska kind of took away the people were able to have like fish sites and things wherever they wanted to, and I think that kind of was taken away when the natives had their native land claim, because the people had to. I'm not sure what happened with that, but I believe that they had to pay for the land or rent their land for the separate areas or whatever. So the urbanization came because people became Kodiak. It's no longer just a sleeping fishing village. But they had a big business coming in.
Were the canneries already operating here before the earthquake, and at such a large scale as they are now?
There seems to always have been a cannery row. May not have been quite as large scale as, but every not quite as many canneries there are today. But at that time, the Kodiak was the crab capital of the world, and that was a booming business, and that brought in a lot of $1 million. And more dollars brought in more big boats people wanted to build. Canneries have always been there, maybe not as quite as huge as some of them don't.
What about the transients?
I think the ferry system probably affected the transients more than anything, plus having flights more than once a day or twice a week or whatever, in and out of Kodiak, more access to the island. I believe the ferry probably did that. The testimony really affected the habit transits, because college kids would come up to work in counties every year because they could make good money, you know. $1,000 a month working in a county. That's good pay in those days.
Did you work at all when you were living in Kodiak?
Actually, after I graduated from high school, I got a steady job. I worked under a work program, I think it was for I'm not sure what work study program with the National Bank of Alaska as a bookkeeper trainee, and stayed with them off and on for 10 years, bookkeeping, tallying, and whatever else. And I really enjoyed it, and I got to know a large part of Kodiak's population through that, the business and professional people. And I like to see things balance out, so that was a fun thing to do.
When did you go to college?
I actually went to Kodiak Community College for one semester, and took Western Civ and something else, and I really didn't care for it, so I just dropped out. Then I went to, I wanted to travel, because I'd never been off an island, never, or even, had been on the mainland a couple of times, but not really enough to make a big difference. So I was affiliated with the college is affiliated with my church. I decided to look into those because I knew they would be smaller. I wouldn't be so intimidated by a smaller college. So I applied for one of the city college in Portland, Oregon. Was accepted, and I went there one semester in 73 and 75. And then I moved back home and went to work in bank in between times, and my dad was aging, and I was concerned about his health and everything, so I'd finally had my brother moved back to Kodiak, and after settling my dad with him, I went back to college in 1977 to Anderson College, which is in Indiana. I went from the west coast to the east, and while I was there, my dad passed away, and so I came back and went back to work at the bank again. So I got fed up with them and their system, and I quit, and I was unemployed for a while. I was doing bookkeeping for individual companies on a personal basis for them. And applied at Canon and got the job working in the payroll department there in 1980, 1981. And after working payroll, they opened me a new dental clinic, and so I transferred down there and helped establish their dental clinic by being the person that got to order all the supplies and everything, and go to Anchorage and work with the Indian first were ordering all their supplies since they had to order through the government there. That was an interesting experience, and I really appreciate the experience. In fact, that's where I met our now Guru Mayor, Jerome Sullivan.
When did you meet your husband?
Oh, that was when I went to college for the fourth time? Third time. Fourth time, yeah. And this time I decided I really wanted to teach, because I just didn't see any business world going anywhere with me. So I went back to college. This time I went to Texas to a small Bible college there. And I met my husband there in 1983. And I spent 3 years there in college finishing up. And I went to summer school too to get my degree, and we met there in 83. We were both interested in a club there. We were both in a missions club there, and I think another, we had mutual friends too. So we met there. And we got married in 1985 and moved back to Alaska, up the Fairbanks, and things didn't work out completely there for what he was working on, and so we went to spend a year, well, not less than a year, with his brother in Michigan, Flint, Michigan, and I taught in the inner city schools there as a substitute every day of the week. And then my friend wrote and said there was an opening at the Kodiak Christian School here, so I applied. And since the Alaska Natives wanted Native people teaching in the school systems, I was able to get some financial aid to come up here to be interviewed, and also for our family to move here. And so we moved lock, stock, and barrel back up to Alaska in 1986, and we've been here ever since. This is my 10th year teaching at Kodiak Christian School, and my husband's 9th year that we try and break in. Now he's breaking with them to move on to the school district, working with them.
Can you tell us a little bit about the story of Kodiak Christian School?
I first knew about Kodiak Christian School vaguely because of some of the people I knew who were teaching here through friends. And then one year I helped them, the year that I was between bank and Canada, I helped them with their yearbook because I was doing bookkeeping for one of the parents, carpentry company he had, and so his wife was in charge of the putting together the yearbook, so I helped with her. And you'll find my name in the yearbook. I believe that was in 1979, I think. And I knew all the people who established the school prior to that because I've been in the community long enough. In a small community, you meet everybody. And I'd known them from going to the most of them were affiliated with the Bible Chapel. I knew them through that. And that was my first time in contact with the school. I also knew, that's how I also met Mike Rosted, who now works with the St. Carmen Seminary. He was teaching at the school at that time. I think he was teaching at fifth or sixth grade or something like that.
So when you first came with the Kodiak Christian School, where was it located? That was 1985?
1986. 1986, it was at the Kodiak Community Church, and it has been here, past years, since then. It also had been housed at the New Assembly of God Church over off of East Rosanna there for a couple of years because of the population of the school expanding. They had the 4th through 8th grade over there for a few years. And it just fluctuates depending on the population of the school, fluctuates depending on the course of transient society here, coming and going to people. In fact, in the graduation class of 8th grade this year, there are 3 students I had that were my 2nd graders, and my class at that time had 14 students, and only 3 of them were left for that class graduating, just myself, following me or somewhere.
This is a really interesting story. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your brothers and sisters and where they've gone or if they're still here?
Okay, originally I said there were 14 Brandos, and 4 of them are now deceased. My favorite brother, there were 9 girls and 9 boys with the Brando-y combination together.